106, this is WHYY.
I'm Marty Moscoe, and welcome to Radio Times. Philadelphia has a problem of gun-related violence. Last year, there were more than 1,400 shooting victims in the city. Of the 324 murders in 2011, 265 of them were committed by someone using a firearm. There were also 3,600 reported robberies by someone using a gun and more than 2,500 aggravated assaults that involved a gun. Our guest, Philadelphia District Attorney Seth Williams, wrote an op-ed after the Rampage shooting in Newtown, Connecticut, calling for common sense gun legislation. And we asked him to join us today in Radio Times. And Seth Williams, nice to have you back on the show.
Good morning, Marty. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Oh, outstanding. Happy holidays.
Same to you. It seems to me that Philadelphia's problem with guns is really very different from the shooting rampage in Newtown, Connecticut, in that in Philadelphia, shooting is a common, almost everyday experience.
Yeah, that's great. You know, first, my heart goes out to those families in Newtown. I have three daughters, and I can't imagine how I would feel if I were to lose one of them. And they were just innocent children, so my heart goes out to those families. But you know, as you're mentioning, the gun violence in Philadelphia is a daily occurrence. We have almost one act of a shooting in Philadelphia about every 6 hours. And as you mentioned, we're up to 330 homicides as of this morning. And 84% of them are the direct result of people using guns. And so in addition to those homicides, we have about an additional 5 people get shot every day for every one that dies as a result of the gun violence. And we would have many more homicides but for the great trauma centers that we have here in Philadelphia at University of Pennsylvania and Temple and Albert Einstein. So, yes, I believe that the time has long passed for us to have a serious and honest and open discussion about how we can reduce the gun violence.
Does that require, though, a very specific focus, even legislation, even regulation for cities like Philadelphia? We know that Chicago is also experiencing a high rate of gun-related violence.
Yes, Chicago's violence is higher than ours. Harrisburg, you know, in Dauphin County here in Pennsylvania, they have a higher rate of gun violence per capita than we do. But yes, I think, you know, we have to have a holistic approach. So we have to address everything, of course. We have to, of course, focus on improving the quality of education, economic opportunity, public health, mental health. All of those are connected. And as I say every time on your radio show, to be an advocate for any one of those, public safety, economic development, education, and public health, we have to be an advocate for all four of them. So we do have to have a holistic approach, and hopefully I can talk to you about why that is, because we drill down as to why the homicides occur, then we can actually use more of a scientific and an empirical method, I hope, of trying to address them.
Well,
but yes, we do have to have different laws affecting the availability, the accessibility of handguns.
Well, I know in Philadelphia from conversations I've had with you and from others, which is we're talking about in this city a small percentage of people who are responsible for most of the violence and probably the gun-related violence as well, and they live in very specific parts of the city.
Yes.
What can be done to address that very specific
right.
problem?
And so, you know, I took over the district attorney's office with a plan for community-based prosecution. I reorganized the office geographically. That's evolved now to where we're working with the police department. We've created what's called GunStat, where we use the empirical data we put up on the computer screen, the analytics. It's called a heat map, where we actually show where the gun violence is. We can identify the most violent neighborhoods. We're now working with the police also to, as you mentioned, identify those that we believe are most responsible for the violence. In Philadelphia, about 5% of the defendants commit 60% of the crimes,
wow.
but it's a very small percentage that are most likely to be shot and also most likely to do the shooting. So we can identify those most at risk. The question is, do we have the political will to stop it? And I think we haven't done enough in the past, but we really have to use our time now more wisely, our resources more wisely, to protect those young lives.
One of the things that you wrote in your op-ed, which was on December 21st, that Philadelphia really should do what New York has done, which
yes.
is mandatory prison sentence for someone in the possession of an illegal gun.
Correct. And so what does that mean? I think we have to do all that we can to reduce the number of guns that are in the stream of commerce. And also we have to send the message that if you carry a gun illegally, you are going to jail. So in Philadelphia, in Pennsylvania, when you carry a gun without a license, right, it's a misdemeanor of the first degree, and the judge could give you probation. We are trying to do all that we can to send the message now here in Philadelphia that you're going to go to jail. So as you recall, last January we had a spike in homicides. We're about 65% higher than the year-to-date of last year. So we instituted something that I stole from St. Louis, where they asked for high bail. So, you know, when you get arrested, the judge, the magistrate can give you bail or keep you in prison. We started asking for $25,000 to $100,000 each time a person was arrested. And the most serious charge was just the illegal possession of a handgun. So we can send the message that if you carry a gun illegally, you're going to stay in jail. But I want to change the law in Harrisburg so that it'll be a mandatory sentence for the people that illegally possess them, so that the judge has to give them at least a state sentence of 1 year if you carry a gun illegally. It worked significantly in New York. They have a state sentence of 3.5 years if you carry a gun illegally. The most popular, if you will, most known defendant to be sentenced was a guy who played for the New York Giants, Plaxico Burress. Everybody knows him. He won a Super Bowl 2008. He had the winning touchdown. He went to a party. He had a gun in his pocket. He shot himself in the leg. Didn't hurt anybody but himself. But he had to go to jail for a mandatory period. The message went out in New York: if you carry a gun illegally and the police catch you, you're going to jail. They used to have about 2,400 homicides or more a year in New York. They have a population of about 9 million. Last year, it was down to about 460. Philadelphia, we have about 1.5 million people, and we had 326 last year. So they have figured out a way both to reduce the number of people that sell the guns illegally and those that possess them. So another corollary to what we have to do also, I believe, is we have to pass a law in Harrisburg to make it mandatory for people that lose their guns, or if their gun is stolen, that they have to report it as being lost or stolen. So you might scratch your head, well, Seth, well, how's that going to help? Almost all of the guns, that were used illegally in Philadelphia this year, gunpoint robberies, the shootings, the homicides, were possessed by people that had them illegally.
These were illegal guns.
Illegal guns.
Illegally.
They didn't have a license. They didn't buy them legally. They didn't stand in line to get them legally. They got them illegally. The supermajority of them purchased them from people we call straw purchasers. A person that can lawfully go buy a handgun buys one or more and then sells them to people that can't get them legally because of convictions, because of mental health problems, because of domestic violence background, who can't get them legally. So we have to also stop that, stop the flow of commerce of these handguns, and punish those people that are profiting off of the bloodshed. So one way to do that is that when people don't report their guns lost or stolen, what happens is someone uses them illegally. We can trace the bullet back to the handgun. We can then trace the handgun back to the point of origin. We then send detectives to the home of the person who bought the gun, and they go, oh, you know what, Marty? Someone broke into my home 3 weeks ago, and they didn't steal the flat-screen TVs, the radio that I listened to, Radio Times. The only thing that was stolen from my home was that gun, and there's nothing we can do about it. So if we have people making it mandatory for them to report their guns lost or stolen, it would reduce that. We also have
Hold on 1 second, only because I need to reintroduce you very briefly. That's Seth Williams. He's the district attorney of Philadelphia, the first of two guests in this hour of Radio Times. We're talking about the problem of gun violence, gun crimes here in Philadelphia. He wrote an op-ed recently after the Rampage shooting in Newtown, Connecticut. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. One of the things that you wrote in this op-ed was banning assault weapons and high-capacity clips.
Yes.
How will you get that through Harrisburg?
Well, I mean, I think a lot of these things, unfortunately, we have to figure out, you know, how are we going to appease the NRA, unfortunately. And so, you know, they try to claim that they represent the deer hunters and this, that, and the other. There is no reason. It's illegal to use an assault weapon hunting. There's no animal that you're allowed to hunt in Pennsylvania that you can use an assault weapon. So clearly, I believe there's no reason for us to sell them. Law enforcement, yes. Military, of course. but there is no reason for anyone to have an assault weapon that has the capacity of such firepower to kill so many people. In Philadelphia, about 80% of the homicides are caused by people who are part of the drug trade. But what's interesting is that they're not using them to defend their property, the drugs, the corner, as we would imagine from watching movies or bad TV shows. These guns are used by these people because of arguments. 159 of our homicides so far this year, it's almost half, were just because of an argument.
Mm.
So it's a poor conflict resolution. And they have accessibility to handguns, and they end up using the handgun to settle a dispute over something as stupid as someone fouled somebody too hard in basketball or some perceived disrespect. And so if we didn't have those handguns, people say it's the guns don't kill people, people kill people. Yeah, people are stupid, and they have too many guns, and that allows them to kill too many people. So we have to address in a holistic way, again, teaching kids better ways of conflict resolution, yes, better schools, better athletic programs after school, recreational libraries, yes, all of those things are necessary. But clearly the common denominator here with what's going on in Philadelphia, Chicago, what happened in Connecticut, the unfortunate gun violence that we see in Harrisburg, is the accessibility, the availability of handguns.
Let me ask you one more thing, and you talk also about, and I'm quoting here, modernizing the involuntary commitment laws in Pennsylvania. The law is now basically if you're a danger to yourself or others, then you can be committed. But even looking at Adam Lanza, he had no criminal record. He had access to legal guns. How are you going to do that?
Yeah, a significant percentage of these, well, clearly the majority of these cases of these mass shootings, the defendant, the shooter, has mental health problems. And what I spoke of when I talked about modernizing is that, yeah, you can commit someone, but this people, they can almost just walk out. They can say they don't want to stay. We have to change some of the rules here in Pennsylvania so that concerned family members, friends, can get people committed for longer periods of time and then to be evaluated by a neutral doctor or medical physician to see whether or not they need to remain inpatient treatment for the better of that person and society as a whole.
We're almost out of time here. The NRA has called for essentially arming schools or having armed guards in schools. Now, that's true in some Philadelphia schools. Has that been effective?
I can't use the language that I would like to use about how dumb an idea I think it is to give every teacher a handgun. I'll be polite because I'm on your radio show, Marty, and I like you, and I don't want you to lose your license. We don't need to give every teacher a handgun. We don't need to have more guns in schools. It's the exact opposite. We need less guns in our society. We need a more peaceful society. That's what we need, and we all need to work together for that goal.
Well, Seth Williams, thank you for joining us today on Radio Times.
Have a great day, Marty.
You too. And he's the Philadelphia District Attorney joining us, the first of two guests in this hour of Radio Times. We will continue our conversation talking with Mark Fulman from Mother Jones and with you at 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, the Garrett and Tatiana Copeland Arrhythmia Center at ChristianaCare offers care for people who experience irregular heartbeat, also known as arrhythmia. For those with a racing heart or one that beats too slowly, who have had problems with their heartbeat or have fainted, an arrhythmia assessment may be needed. ChristianaCare encourages people with these symptoms to talk to a doctor. For more information or to make an appointment, 800-693-CARE or ChristianaCare.org/arrhythmia.
2012 has been a year filled with complex events. From the Jersey Shore in Delaware to Center City in Princeton, WHYY is proud to cover the stories that matter to you through our in-depth local news services, Newsworks Tonight, Radio Times, and Newsworks.org. Each illuminate what matters most to you. Help us cover the next important story. Make your year-end tax-deductible gift to WHYY. Visit whyy.org/support.
Say hello 2013 with Toast of the Nation. I'm Rhonda Hamilton with John Scofield in Boston, Wynton Marcellus in New York, Dee Alexander's vocal tribute to Jimi Hendrix and James Brown in Chicago, and from California, Gordon Goodwin's Big Fat Band, New Year's Eve on Toast of the Nation from NPR Music.
Monday night at 10 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times. I'm Artie Moss-Cohen. The tragic and violent deaths of 20 first graders and 6 teachers in Newtown, Connecticut, have focused the nation's attention once again on the problem of rampage shooting. Sadly, this was just the latest mass murder of this year. In the summer, Mother Jones published a comprehensive survey of mass shootings over the last 30 years. One of the findings was that most of the killers got their guns legally. We asked Mark Fulman, senior editor of Mother Jones, to join us. He led the nonprofit investigative news organization's reportings on these mass shootings over the last 30 years. He's a former editor at Salon and co-founder of Media Bugs. And Mark Fulman, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Glad to be with you. Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. And I'm curious about why you wanted to mount this investigation, which of course predates what happened in Newtown, Connecticut.
Well, we actually started this investigation back in July after the Aurora movie theater mass shooting occurred, and it really started with a simple question. I mean, that event was also, you know, completely horrifying to wake up to that news, and it just provoked the question for us, how many times has this actually happened? We keep hearing about it in the news, and so we started looking into it, and realized very quickly that there was no good comprehensive survey or set of data on mass shootings in the United States, and so we set out to track them and built our investigative project around that. We ended up finding 62 mass shootings in the last 30 years in the United States. That includes Newtown, of course. We couldn't have anticipated that that would follow Aurora, although we had already identified a pattern of them happening and an increase in frequency. So in a certain sense, it was to be expected, sadly.
Well, and what you found was that almost half of those cases happened since the year 2006.
That's right. It's been a rising trend, to be sure, of this particular type of mass shooting. We wanted to focus on these events that take place in public places, like schools, workplaces, shopping malls, movie theaters, religious buildings. There was also the Sikh temple shooting in Milwaukee a few weeks after Aurora, of course. And using a baseline of 4 fatalities, which is the guideline the FBI uses to define mass murder, we wanted to study that specifically in public venues. And we found that this has indeed been on the rise in the last few years. This year, 2012, is the worst year yet in 30 years with 7 mass shootings, 7 such mass shootings this year.
What you also found, and this is going back to the year 1995, there were something like 200 million guns in possession in the U.S., and today it's closer to 300 million. That's 100 million difference in the last, let's say, 15 years. What do you think explains that? Is it more people with more guns, the same number of people with more guns? What explains this increase in weapons buying?
Actually, my understanding is that there are fewer people with guns. Now, household ownership of guns has been declining long-term in the United States. However, there are far more firearms available and possessed in the United States. It's a hard thing to measure. We only have estimates based on government surveys and sales data, and that's in part because it's so difficult to track guns in the United States due to the legislative landscape. So, but there's undoubtedly been a large increase in the amount of guns in the U.S. over the last decade or two, and although fewer people own them, there are a lot more guns not only in circulation, but they're much easier to carry in public. There have been a wave of laws in the last few years making it legal to carry guns in public in a number of states around the country.
In fact, your piece says that it's easier to own a gun these days because of gun laws, more lax gun laws, easier to carry in public, and actually harder for the government to track. Harder how?
Well, for example, there was a law passed in Virginia a couple years ago where the state said that licensed gun dealers no longer had to report sales of handguns. And not only that, they mandated that all such previous records of sales had to be destroyed. So it's a good example of a state basically making it impossible to track what's happening with handguns within that state, and that's happened in a number of places in the last few years.
Well, you know what we're going to do, Mark, only because we have a really terrible phone line, and I want to get you on a better phone line. We're going to hang up on you and call you back. In the meantime, let me reintroduce both of our guests and our topic, the rampage shooting in Newtown, Connecticut, that killed 20 school children, 20 first graders, 6 teachers, and the shooter's mother. Of course, it continues to shock the nation. It has raised a whole host of questions about gun violence and gun regulation. President Obama has vowed to make gun control a top priority in his administration come the new year. The NRA has blamed things like Hollywood, violent Hollywood movies, and violent video games. We just spoke with Philadelphia's District Attorney Seth Williams talking about the peculiar and particular problem of gun violence in cities like Philadelphia. And we are talking with Mark Fulman. He's senior editor at Mother Jones, led the nonprofit investigative news organizations reporting on the 62 mass shootings in the U.S. over the last 30 years. That includes 7 in this year, the year 2012. He's a former editor of Salon, a co-founder of Media Bugs. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Mother Jones, one of a number of publications that has been investigating our gun laws, who owns guns, who has access to guns, what regulation might look like, the role of the NRA and others. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. And one of the findings from this Mother Jones report was that most of the killers looking at 30 years of rampage shooting got their guns legally, which of course raises a whole host of questions. And we know from the shooting in Connecticut, Adam Lanza got his mother's guns, and she had gotten them legally, and of course he used them to just horrific effect in Newtown, Connecticut. And I believe, Mark Fulman, we have you back on the phone, and hopefully this is a better phone line.
Yes, sorry about the connection.
That's okay, and I can't blame it on you. This is just something that happens sometimes. Let me just give out that phone number again, and it's 1-888-477-9499. Mark, going back to your investigation and looking at these, you know, sadly, these 62 mass shootings over the last 30 years, are there patterns when it comes to the shooter, when it comes to the weapon, when it comes to the situation, the part of the country? Are there things that we can draw from these shootings to help us understand them?
Yes, I think absolutely. It's certainly a complicated equation. But when we set out to do this investigation at Mother Jones, we wanted to not just figure out how often this had happened, but start looking closely at the details of how and why. So we found a number of very interesting, striking patterns. One is that in the 62 cases we studied, the vast majority of them, the killers obtain their weapons legally through essentially purchasing them through licensed gun sellers. In most cases, it was roughly 80% of the cases. We also looked at the profile of the perpetrators. The vast majority of them are white males, average age of 35. And the other thing that we found that I think is quite telling and points to a crucial part of this equation is that there was a very strong pattern of mental health problems among these killers. 36 of the cases ended in suicide, murder suicides. Another 7 of them ended in police shootouts, which law enforcement officials widely considered to be suicide by cop, meaning the shooter was in a situation they knew they would never escape from. And in quite a number of these cases, more than half, we found at least some indication of possible mental illness displayed by the perpetrator prior to them going out and killing.
And when you talk about mental illness, of course, that, you know, that can cover so many different kinds of diagnoses, everything from depression to you know, more serious forms of psychosis. Were you able to dig a little deeper on that?
That's right. This is an area that's very, very complex, and we have to be careful. We at Mother Jones did not make any diagnoses. That's beyond our expertise. But and as you say, there's a wide range of what we might call mental health problems or mental illness. It's important to note that the vast majority of people who have mental health problems are not violent people.
Exactly.
And yet the people who do this particular type of crime overwhelmingly have seem to have, appear to have some type of mental health problem, mental illness. The range, as I understand it, is essentially problems including paranoid schizophrenia. If you look at Jared Loughner in Tucson, that's what he suffered from. You also have a lot of, I think, suicidal depression. Clearly, I mean, so many of these cases end in suicide. There's some sociopaths involved in these cases. One of the shooters at Columbine is considered to be a sociopath. So that's the typical range that we're talking about with mental illness with these types of killers. But it's a vexing problem to try to figure out exactly what went wrong with these people. And I think more importantly, you have to look at how they had such easy access to weapons, particularly the ones who had shown prior signs of mental illness. The guy who committed the worst mass killing in recent history at Virginia Tech had been under mental health treatment. We know the same about James Holmes in Aurora, had been seeing a psychiatrist for years for serious mental health problems that appear to have been some form of schizophrenia, although I don't know that that's been confirmed.
But what we don't know is whether they gave any indication that they were going to engage in these, you know, violent rampage shootings. And I know even with Adam Lanza, there's much we don't know about this this young man, but he apparently had access to his mother's guns and she had bought them legally, which raises questions about responsible gun ownership. If someone in the family has, you know, some problems, don't you make sure that you lock your guns and that they don't have the key or the combination?
Right. It's like I said, this is a complicated issue, and right. In a way, the Newtown case is somewhat of an anomaly in our data set of 62 mass shootings, because that, you know, Lanza was able to get the weapon from his mother. That's not a case we would consider to be where the shooter obtained the weapon legally. His mother did, but you know, we wouldn't say that it was legal for him to have the weapon. But you know, there's only so much you can legislate in terms of access to weapons. I think that, you know, maybe points to the limitations. That said, the type of weaponry that she had, I think, is certainly up for question. I mean, extremely powerful semi-automatic rifle that's essentially a military-style weapon. The type of highly lethal ammunition he was able to possess. You know, I think there's a very serious question as to whether or not that stuff should be available widely or even at all.
Wayne LaPierre, in an interview over the weekend and also last Friday, talked about, you know, good guys with guns versus bad guys with guns. I know part of your investigation, looking at some of these rampage shootings where either there were or there weren't either armed civilians, or even in the case of the Virginia Tech, I know that they had the university had their own security force there. Looking at good guys with guns versus bad guys with guns, is there any lesson we can draw from this?
Absolutely. To be honest, it's an absurd argument that the NRA and others, their allies, have pushed for many years, and you hear it time and time again after these events occur. Oh, well, let's arm the good people. Let's arm school teachers. Let's give everybody a gun, and then they can stop the bad guys. And it's total nonsense. If you look at first of all, there are very few examples of ordinary citizens with guns trying to intervene in shooting rampages. It happens extremely rarely. And when it does, it sometimes ends badly. I wrote a piece about this specifically for Mother Jones a couple weeks ago and looked at the small handful of cases that these folks cite as examples of allegedly ordinary citizens stopping massacres. And when you look at these cases, they just don't stand up to scrutiny. There's a lot of misdirection and sort of half-truths baked into them using these examples. To give you an example, there are a couple of cases where there are, one case in particular where they point to students having stopped a mass shooting at a law school in Virginia in 2002. And these people that they refer to as students turn out to be current and former law enforcement officers who were armed. And not only that, but by the time they got to the perpetrator, that person, the killer, was out of ammunition. Hmm. So to hold that up as an example of ordinary citizens stopping a massacre is just ludicrous. I've yet to find an example, not only in our data set of 62 mass shooting cases, but much more broadly looking at shooting rampages over the last few decades, yet to find a clear example of an armed, ordinary citizen with no law enforcement background, success. successfully stopping a shooting rampage in its tracks with a gun.
Let me get some callers in at 1-888-477-9499. We have Jim, who has called us up from Cape May. And Jim, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yeah, hi.
Hi there.
Look, here's the thing. We are going at this from a political view, and it's not going to work. If we take our money out of companies that manufacture these types of weapons, such as what a pension company has done, and tell them straight up, look, we're not going to invest in companies that manufacture these kinds of weapons. That starts changing the whole direction. Individual responsibility here, you know?
You're talking, Jim, about consumers essentially using their dollars to influence companies?
Yeah, you go to your stockbroker, you tell him, am I invested in any of these type of companies? And if I am, I'm pulling my money out.
Well, thanks for calling into Radio Times. And Mark Fulman, we're hearing some signs of this in the last couple of weeks since that Newtown shooting.
That's right. I believe there's been some divestment of investment funds in gun manufacturers. And it's an interesting idea that may be one way to bring pressure on them. But, you know, to be honest, I'm not sure that that really is any kind of solution to the problem, only because you can't a marketplace for guns, right? I mean, if you put one company out of business, in theory, though, there's another one to take its place. I think, you know, any solution lies much more in the direction of regulation and law enforcement.
Are you surprised that since the Newtown shooting, there has apparently been a unbelievable sales of guns and ammunition and even, you know, some of these more lethal guns as well?
No, I wouldn't say I'm surprised. It's not unlike when President Obama was first elected in 2008. There was a big spike in gun sales. I think whenever you see the political climate move in this direction, when there's more talk about gun control as an issue and gun violence, then, you know, you see both sides of the equation up the rhetoric, and it creates, I think particularly if you look at the conservative side of the equation, the rhetoric is based very much on fear and ideological pushes against the government, and, you know, this is an attack on our constitutional freedom, Obama's going to come take your guns, etc. So when you have that kind of talk circulating, what are people going to do? Of course they're going to go out and buy a bunch of guns if they think that they're going to be taken away any minute. And so, you know, with this talk resurfacing after Newtown, I don't think it's surprising at all that people are rushing out to buy weapons.
Well, let me take a short break, and let me also say that President Obama has done nothing to curb gun possession. In fact, he relaxed some of the gun laws. Mark Fulman is our guest today on Radio Time, senior editor at Mother Jones, and led the Mother Jones reporting on mass shootings in the U.S. over the last 30 years, found some disturbing parallels and some interesting findings as well. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Much more to talk about after this very short break. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The Philadelphia Orchestra supports WHYY. Yannick Nezet-Séguin and the Philadelphia Orchestra present a New Year's Eve celebration at the Kimmel Center, featuring favorites of the Strauss family, complete with dancers and plenty of surprises. The concert starts at 7:30, and you'll be home by midnight. New Year's Eve tickets at 215-893-1999 or online. This Monday, December 31st, New Year's Eve at the Kimmel Center with Yannick Nezet-Séguin and the Philadelphia Orchestra.
On the next Fresh Air, we continue our holiday series featuring a few of our favorite interviews of the year. We'll hear from Aaron Sorkin, the creator of the TV series The West Wing and this year's HBO series The Newsroom. And we'll hear from this year's National League Cy Young winner R.A. Dickey, who's famous for his knuckleball and was just traded by the Mets to the Blue Jays. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
I'm Sasha Pfeiffer. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. We'll review the new taxes that await some people in 2013. Upper-income households will see a tax increase to pay for President Obama's new health care law. Also, a cyclist looks back on what's being called the sports doping era. That's Public Radio's Daily Digest of News and Culture, here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Mark Fulman, senior editor at Mother Jones, is our guest, talking about a Mother Jones investigation into mass shootings over the last 3 decades. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Mark, let me get another caller. This is Bob from Narvin joining us. And Bob, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yes. I am a gun owner, and I do have a concealed carrying permit. And I have a number of different guns, and I kind of just don't understand the lack of common sense suggestions that have been out there. It seems to be either one end or the other. And some things that didn't make sense to me is, you know, if I was 18 years old, I could go out and purchase a high-capacity, very powerful assault rifle, but I have to be 21 and get background checked to buy a, you know, very much less lethal five-shot hunting revolver.
I'm afraid we're losing Bob, but I think he makes an interesting point, and let me go back to you, Mark Fulman, calling for what he says are some common sense regulations for gun ownership. Let's talk a bit about that from your investigation and from what you have seen. What makes sense to you?
Well, I agree that the caller made a very good point. I do think that there are a number of people offering, you know, what we would call reasonable ideas or common sense solutions. But part of the problem is that the political debate around this issue is so polarized and stuck in such a long-running stalemate that, you know, there's just people won't even begin to consider these ideas. I think, you know, whenever you raise, essentially the caller is talking about gun control, right? He's talking about background checks. He's talking about limiting certain types of weapons for certain people. I think there's a whole range of things that could be done along those lines. If you look at the system right now, it's really, really easy for anyone to go out and get a gun. I think it's 40% of all gun sales in this country now are really not regulated at all. There's no background check, the so-called gun show loophole. I don't know why we still refer to it as a loophole. It's more like a chasm. I mean, between sales of guns on the internet or private person-to-person sales or sales at gun shows, you have, you know, tens of thousands of weapons changing hands without background checks. It seems to me that's a place to start. And when people who are interested in tighter gun regulations start talking about things like that, then you have people on the far right, the NRA crowd, immediately call it an attack on the Second Amendment, on constitutional freedom, it's anti-American, et cetera, et cetera. It turns it immediately into a debate that has nothing to do with reality. And I think that's part of the reason why we don't have a reasonable discussion about regulations. And there are many gun owners, like the caller who just asked the question, who want to see more reasonable gun regulations themselves. They're responsible gun owners in this country. The polls show that a vast majority of Americans, including gun owners, want to see better gun regulation.
One. This is not a perfect parallel, but one of the things that I've been thinking about and others have been thinking and writing about is looking what we do with car ownership. Again, it's not a perfect analogy here, but you have to be licensed. You have to have, you know, updates on your license. You have to pass tests. It's registered. If you sell it, there's a bill of sale. And the vehicle motor people know that you own a car. Look, using that, do you think that's one way to make an argument for reasonable regulations?
Sure, I think it's a generally reasonable analogy. It's essentially we're saying, you know, this is a piece of equipment that is widely used in our society that is dangerous to people if used wrongly, and therefore we need to regulate who has it and how they use it. So I think that's a fair comparison, at least in a basic sense. Another one that I think is interesting that I've seen experts point to in this discussion is secondhand smoke. You know, we've decided as a society in recent years that this is a dangerous thing to people, and so therefore we don't allow it in bars and restaurants and airplanes. And I think that, you know, in a way that points even more essentially to the idea that, you know, if there's something that people feel they are entitled to as a consumer or have a right to, that's fine as long as it's not hurting other people
in society. And when it is, then we have to do something to control that.
Let me get, looks like Nick from Conshohocken to join us on Radio Times. And Nick, go ahead, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks so much for taking my call.
You're very welcome.
I don't want to take up too much time. I would like to say that I am an educator. I have an 18-month-old daughter. I'm a legal owner of firearms. And my first question for Mark, I don't have all my notes with me, we're about to head out the door, is I'd like to know how many of the mass shootings that he studied have occurred outside of gun-free zones versus inside gun-free zones. Because one of the beliefs that myself and others hold is that some of these people, regardless of what kind of carnage they're about to commit, whether it's using a firearm or not, are primarily targeting gun-free zones where people do not have the right to protect themselves. So that's my question. The second thing I'd just like to throw in real quick is that the idea of a gun show loophole for most firearms that people are concerned with, including handguns and certain semi-automatic rifles, is absurd because you need to go, it's a law, that you need to transfer firearms and buy firearms from someone with a federal firearm license. So I'll take my questions or comments offline. Thank you.
I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Two good points. And interestingly, I'm assuming when he talks about some of these gun-free zones, he's talking about schools.
Yeah, well, I'm glad that you raised this notion of the gun-free zone because this is another argument you see perpetuated from conservatives on this issue. And, you know, I appreciate the question. With all due respect, it's also nonsense. There is no evidence that the people who commit these crimes, the mass shooters, are deliberately going out and shooting people in places that they know aren't allowed to have guns. Look at the case in Aurora, for example. People say, oh, James Holmes picked the movie theater in town that was a, quote, gun-free zone. Mm-hmm. Well, my understanding is that that theater posted a sign or made it known that they didn't want to allow guns, but that has nothing to do with the legal regulation of the state. It's a private business. Furthermore, there's just no evidence that somebody like James Holmes, who clearly had serious mental health problems, was deciding to go out and shoot people in a place because guns weren't allowed there. I don't see where that argument's coming from in terms of evidence. There's not a single case we looked at where there was anything to indicate that a shooter picked a place specifically because they knew it was a, quote, gun-free zone.
And picking up on his second point and reading your article and also articles from others, my understanding is that only sales of guns by federally licensed arms dealers require a background check. First of all, do I have that correct? And then does that open up this gun loophole?
Well, this is an area where I don't have as much detail. I'm not well-versed in the specific regulations of what happens at gun shows. So the caller may be right in terms of that there are some requirements with sales at gun shows, but my understanding generally, as has been reported widely, that when you buy guns at gun shows, they aren't subject to the same kind of federal background checks that you have to go through when you buy from a licensed dealer. That's certainly the case with the Internet as well. I mean, there are people who are posting guns for sale online and meeting people and handing over the gun, and that's, from what I can see, that's an entirely unregulated area. There have been some undercover investigations of this done by Mayors Against Illegal Guns. Michael Bloomberg's group has looked into this and basically did a sting operation, which they posted online, where they listed a gun for sale, got someone to tell them over the phone that they wouldn't have qualified for a background check because of a criminal record or otherwise, and then went out and sold them the gun anyway. Clearly, this is happening plenty.
Let me get, looks like Lou from Allentown to join our conversation. And Lou, go ahead, you're on Radio Times. Number three, that would be Lou. Do we have you, Lou? No, we don't have Lou? Okay, well, we'll figure out our callers at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Mark, before we get to some more callers here, how do you see the NRA?
Well, that's an interesting question. I think, you know, it's interesting to look at how the NRA is operating today. The press conference that Wayne LaPierre held last Friday I think, said quite a lot. And really, frankly, it was pretty outrageous, I think, for him to stand up and start talking about violent video games and calling to arm every school in the United States. The day, a week after Newtown, when you've got parents still burying their first graders, it just seemed incredibly callous to turn it immediately and solely into an ideological platform, you know, to push the same old talking points about arming good guys, which, as I described earlier, is really a myth. But it's interesting, too, because there are, as I said earlier, there's been polling done recently, including one by Frank Luntz, a Republican pollster, of gun owners in this country who, by and large, don't agree with the NRA talking points. They want to see tighter gun regulation. They aren't seeing everything through the lens of a pure all-out battle over the Second Amendment. So there does seem to be a disconnect between the extremism being voiced at the top of the NRA's leadership and perhaps the majority of its membership.
The New York Times had an interesting piece last week, and I'm just going to quote here from an editorial on it titled "The Gun Game Complex." In its bizarre response last week to the shootings in Newtown, Connecticut, the NRA heaped blame on, quote, vicious, violent video games for corrupting young Americans, calling them the filthiest form of pornography. And I'm continuing here, quoting, as it turns out, many of those very games have marketing relationships with the makers of firearms and ammunition, which are also big financial supporters of the NRA through deals that appear to be designed to increase sales of their deadly wares. There apparently is no connection between video games and rampage shooting. But I think it is interesting to see how some of the gun companies have teamed up with some of these video games that, you know, are pretty violent to play.
Yeah, and I think that makes a lot of people uncomfortable when you look at that. There's no explicit evidence that connects playing violent video games with people who go out and commit violence. But I do think it's a legitimate question whether or not, you know, weapons manufacturers should be advertising on violent video games in terms of the type of behavior it's glorifying. But I also think it's important to note that when the NRA talks about this stuff, you know, blaming violent video games and violent movies, you know, this is a classic tactic of theirs to really direct the conversation away from what is much more important, what's much more crucial to this equation, which is the access to weapons in this country. The NRA would love to have a discussion all day long about whether or not violent video games cause kids to go out and kill people. They don't want to talk about, should kids be able to go out to a Sportsman's Warehouse in Tucson like Jared Lochner did, and buy high-capacity magazines and 9mm Glocks.
Let me get Mike from Rehoboth, Delaware, to join us. Mike, go ahead. You're on Radio Times. Number two, that would be Mike. We don't have Mike. We're not getting Mike as well. Let me pick up on something you said earlier, and this is actually Frank Luntz, who is a Republican pollster, did some polling for mayors against illegal guns, finding in their survey 80% of NRA members agree that support for the Second Amendment rights goes hand-in-hand with keeping guns out of the hands of criminals. There's very strong support for criminal background checks among NRA members and gun owners, which seems to me just speaks, Mark, to the fact that there is a lot of middle ground here that people can actually agree on.
Yeah, I would agree. I think, again, like I was saying earlier, I think that the inertia and political stalemate around this issue has, by and large, been cultivated by the NRA leadership and the extremists on the right, who turn every discussion of gun regulation into a referendum on constitutional freedom. That's not what it's about. People who have ideas for reform, or people who are in the center, or gun owners who want to see responsible ownership and regulation, they're not interested in banning guns, outlawing guns entirely. This is not an argument about taking all the guns out of America. It's a discussion about the fact that we have roughly 300 million guns in this country, and if we're going to live with them in a way that is more reasonable and safer, then we need to talk about what that means.
Let me see if I can squeeze one more caller on. This is Barry from Claymont.
Yes,
Barry.
Hello, this is Barry.
Go ahead, Barry.
You may have already mentioned, but I think one of the major problems that's going to have to be resolved before they're going to be able to have a sensible discussion and put some sensible policies in place about gun gun possession is going to be the lobbying. The gun manufacturers are using enormous amounts of money to lobby our politicians, and our politicians essentially end up working for them. And it's not just just a problem with gun possession. It's a problem with the banking industry. It's a problem with every industry in this company or in this country. And until they resolve that corrupt form of governance, the United States is in trouble. We don't have politicians that are making sensible decisions. They're beholden to the gun industry and all of the various lobbying industries, and that's the problem. And I'm amazed that people aren't talking about this with every problem, including the economy.
Well, I appreciate the call, and just speaking to the power of the gun lobby in Washington. Is he correct, Mark?
Well, I think there's no doubt that the NRA has done a terrific job over the years of creating the kind of political climate that it wants around this issue, with their whole rating system of politicians and the money that they use to target political leaders who don't agree with them in election cycles. They've made it very difficult for politicians to talk about gun control. So I think in that sense, that is an accurate assessment. I think also it's interesting to think about the notion of just pure money and profit in this equation and gun manufacturers, because you can look at some of these talking points from the NRA and their allies and see ways in which they may just be cynically trying to cultivate gun sales by raising the fear of the government coming to take your guns, et cetera.
Well, on that note, Mark Fulman, thank you for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thanks so much for having me.
You're welcome. And he's a senior editor at Mother Jones. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out much more about this program, including Facebook and Twitter, podcasts, email, Sirius Radio. It's all there. whyy.org/radiotimes. I'm Marty Moscoen. Thank you so much for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times. But stay with us. We'll be right back.
For a limited time at Verizon, you can get our best price ever for a single line. Just $45 per month when you bring your phone, which is less than you spend on too tired to cook takeout every week. Get one line on unlimited welcome for $45 per month with AutoPay plus taxes and fees. Visit your local Columbus Verizon store by April 2nd to save. $20 monthly promo credits applied over 36 months with a new line on unlimited welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Additional terms apply.